You know, it's always interesting to learn about the latest research and work that's being done on sustainable energy. There's a whole lot of it going on at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has been going on for quite some time now. And my guests today are going to talk about their research that puts carbon back into the soil while still helping the biofuel industry. And John Greenerback, who's been with us a whole bunch of times, Director of Education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And John, great to have you back.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Larry.
And Anna Cates, who's doing some really cool research, GLBRC affiliate, Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, that's the GLBRC. She's an agronomy PhD student, and thank you so much, Anna, for being with us today. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Larry. It's great to be here.
Well, when you take, and your research revolves around corn.
Right. I'm working in corn fields because that's the most widespread cropping system in the Midwest and also produces a lot of biofuel, which could potentially be recycled back into the soil.
Yeah, and a lot of it involves those corn stalks.
Right. The corn stalks are the part we're interested in, so we're not competing with food uses for the grain. The stalks have some competition for environmental purposes, though, because we do like to see that reincorporated into the soil and becoming soil carbon.
So she's doing some really interesting research on this, and I hope you, as you listen in, I hope you'll call in with your questions and comments as we move along here. What do you think? Is it important to find alternative energy sources? Maybe you have questions about how biofuels work. Maybe you have questions about corn as a fuel source and what other kinds of fuel sources are there out there. Join in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page, and our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. So give us a call, shoot us an email, or go online to our Facebook page. So what are the benefits? Talk a little bit more about the benefits that corn stalks provide the soil.
Right, so having any crop residue going back into the soil, that has the potential to become soil organic matter. Soil organic matter is a really small proportion of the overall soil mass, but it's important. You'll see it because it gives soil its color, the blackness to it. And then you'll also see increased fertility when you have increased soil organic matter.
So we're putting that into the soil, but putting those stalks into the soil, but it has can have other uses too.
Yeah, sure. The stalks could also be used for biofuels, of course. That's the focus of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to figure out what's the happy medium. Can we take some of the stalks for ethanol production, and can we leave some on the soil and have them transition into soil carbon eventually, which is a slow process, slower than the conversion to ethanol.
Yeah. And actually, how do we take stalks and convert them to ethanol, John?
So it's a multi-step process. So really the stalks, that fibrous plant material, and actually there's other sources as well. We could talk about things like wheat straw, for example, which is being harvested right now in our countryside. But essentially there's a couple main compounds that make up that fibrous plant materials. A big one is a polymer called cellulose, and it's really just it's glucose beads on a string. If you can kind of visualize that. And so we need to kind of loosen up that that very dense material. It's mainly cell wall material. Loosen it up so we can get to those polymers. And then through any of a number of different means, using enzymes is a big area of research, we can break that polymer up into molecules of glucose. And then once we get to glucose, we're in kind of the age-old domain of fermentation using yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, to ferment to ethanol is the traditional end product, but we can make any of a number of different kinds of fuels. Through that fermentation, through a couple different metabolic pathways, we can even make diesel, or we can make jet fuel as well. So
there's lots of ways to use it, and we've actually, I know we've had in the past when you've been on, we talked about it. People have kind of complained a little bit about corn as a source for ethanol. As I guess the conversation has always kind of gone along the lines of, well, you're spending so much energy to make this energy.
Right. Yeah, and it's tricky when we talk about corn. You know, as Anna was saying, there's the corn grain. So currently, you know, when we think about biofuels, when we think about the, you know, the 10% ethanol fuel mix that we're putting in our cars today, E10, that's largely made with corn grain, which mm-hmm. is a starch-based material. Once again, starch is actually also a polymer of glucose. So once again, we can take that get that glucose out and make fuel. So we're really talking about something fundamentally different here, where we're you know, the grain is being used for animal feed or for human food, and then we're taking this residue material, the what they call stover in the farming world. It's the stalk, it's the stem, it's the leaves, it's the cob, and turning that into fuel instead. So.
Talking today with John Greenler, Director of Education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and Anna Cates, Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center affiliate with the Department of Agronomy. She's working on her PhD on the use of on using corn remnants to make biofuels, and how do we replace the nutrients that are kind of lost when we pull those corn stalks out of the field. She's working on cover crops, and we haven't gotten to that yet, but we'll get to that right now. You can join in with your questions or comments. Concerns, questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or again, post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Anna, talk about your research. You're working on cover crops that are going to put carbon back into the soil that we lose when we take the corn stalks mm-hmm. off the
right.
soil.
Yeah, that's about it. So cover crops are great in a couple of ways. One is they're grown when corn isn't growing. So you're actually capturing photosynthetic energy from the sun that corn can't capture, because corn can't grow in November. Corn can't grow in March, but a ryegrass can. And so then you're capturing more carbon than you actually could otherwise. You can also think of that physically. You can grow cover crops in between the rows and maybe capture more mm-hmm. carbon that way. So if we're not going to harvest those cover crops, that can all be tilled back in and maybe leave more corn residue available for ethanol production.
So that's what you're working on, is what kinds of crops are going to work best?
Yeah, and essentially how it all adds up, right? We're going to take some corn away, some carbon in the corn away for ethanol. We're going to take some carbon for food, and then we're going to leave some in the soil. And how much needs to go to each of those allocations in order for it all to add up environmentally, financially, and for the farmer. So.
Oh, that's really cool research. We've got some callers online. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Starting to Daryl in Eau Claire next. Daryl, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. My question was, why can't we use the byproduct of making the ethanol to put back onto the field for the organic matter?
Sure. Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you know, once again, there's a couple different paths that we can be talking about. You know, the vast majority, as I said earlier, of the fuel we're making from corn today is from the grain. And there actually isn't a lot of material left over after the production, because what's going on is there's the starch material, which will be converted into ethanol. But then there is a byproduct, which is known as distiller's grains, that remains afterwards, actually, and that's a very high protein byproduct, which actually makes an excellent animal feed. So that's used and actually is really accounted for when we think about, you know, what we're producing along those lines. When we think about the stover material, once again, the stalks and leaves and cobs and whatnot. Once again, you know, when that gets brought into the refinery, we're essentially able to use all of that material. There's the cellulose. There's actually another sugar-based polymer called hemicellulose, which we can also break down into sugars to make into fuel. Lignin is the third major component of that stover. It's kind of the glue that holds everything together. And it's an interesting story with the lignin. Initially, we thought that that was largely going to be something that wouldn't be of value. But we're now finding that we can turn that, too, into fuels or other types of bioproducts of high value. Hmm. We can also just it can also just be burned as an energy source for heat. And there is the need for heat in terms of a distillation process to concentrate that ethanol. So really, when you look at what's happening at the refinery, there's not a lot coming out the other end. So. Hmm.
Very interesting. Nope. Yeah, and you were going to add something to that as well, Anna?
Yeah, and that's just that I think this gets at a really interesting part of the whole biofuels industry, which is that we have the scientific problems of how we break things down, and then we have a lot of logistical problems. Mm-hmm. We don't have infrastructure for where we store the distillers' grains, where we store the biofuels on the way, and so that may be something, closing the loop and bringing some of the waste product back to the field may be possible, mm-hmm. but that's part of the logistics we don't know yet.
Yeah. And, I guess we lost our caller. I was going to ask if you had a follow-up there. Thank you very much for that call. Karen in Virginia, thank you for calling. Hi.
Well, thank you for the program. I just tuned in, and it's something I'm really interested in. Having traveled across southern Minnesota and then into Wisconsin and through Illinois on the way home, corn horizon to horizon, which is great. But I'm wondering if your guests could discuss the effects of corn growing on the monarch butterfly. We don't see milkweed on the road shoulders as a food source. I think it's pretty important. I don't know enough about it, but maybe your guests do. I'd sure love to see ribbons of milkweed there so that our migrating monarchs could make it north, where I have a huge yard full of milkweed waiting. Yeah. So that we can get, you know, the caterpillars that we're used to. It's been 3 years since I've seen caterpillars here. And maybe they are knowledgeable on that, and I'd love to hear it.
Wow. Karen, you missed a couple of conversations we've had in the last week or so.
I've been away. I'm sorry.
Oh, about that very topic. But, John...
Yeah, excellent, Karen. Thank you very much. Very important topic. So, you know, today we're primarily focused on, you know, talking about, you know, this corn residue opportunity in terms of turning that into fuel. But actually, a lot of the work that we do in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is looking at what we would call marginal lands. This is agricultural acres, which aren't really appropriate for growing these intensive crops such as corn or soybeans. And most farms, you know, there's maybe 10 or 20% of the acreage is what are known as marginal lands. And we're very interested in the opportunity to work with farmers to grow crops, perennial diversified crops, that will still provide fibrous biomass. So once again, in a very similar fashion, we could convert into fuel. But once again, they're based on native species, they're perennial based, and they provide a lot of opportunities for biodiversity, both for insects such as monarchs, also bird species as well. And so, you know, looking at, you know, what's the right kind of composition to be planting in those acres, and how do you get them distributed in the right place to, you know, provide an additional opportunity to farmers, but also to really enhance what we call ecosystem services, all the things that these natural areas can do. And providing habitat for monarchs, I think, has really become kind of a showcase for that. So very important.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad hear all of that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And just so you know, I left some milkweed that really wasn't supposed to be growing where my flower garden, Karen, and I let her go because I wanted to see if we could get some monarchs in. And we have some monarchs at our right in my front lawn.
Yep.
Well, really no front lawn. It's a front flower bed, let's put it that way. So I'm really happy to see those butterflies.
Definitely.
I hope you get them too. George in Madison, we'll get to you in just a second. Hold on. I just want to remind everybody, our guest today talking bioenergy crops and soil nutrition. Anna Cates doing some research on that, on corn stover and using other crops to kind of replace the carbon that we lose when we take the corn stalks off the land. John Greenler, she's an agronomy PhD student. John Greenler directs education for the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. really happy to have John Greenler and Anna Cates with us to talk about the research being done through the Bioenergy Research Center, Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, using corn remnants to make biofuels. Of course, it leaves soil lacking nutrients. And Cates is working on how cover crops can improve soil health and help the biofuel industry at the same time. You can join in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And let's turn to George in Madison next. George, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Contrary to what you hear in some circles, science is a very good thing, and thank you for the work you do. And so is our wonderful state university system. It's also a benefit to all of us. But my concern is it has to do with the carbon that's in our atmosphere. As a layperson, I understand that the reason we're experiencing climate change and the future doesn't look that hot for our children and grandchildren is because of the carbon footprint, and I'm concerned that the production of ethanol just would contribute to that. Am I wrong, or is that something we should talk about?
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And Anna, we'll turn to you. Hi. Thank you for that question again. And Anna, what's on your mind relating to that question?
Well, I think that that is something we're trying to figure out yet, right? In some cases, corn can sequester a little carbon in the soil. But in an agricultural context, carbon sequestered in the soil is always vulnerable to the next time you till. And so we're looking at a lot of perennial cropping systems in order to keep ground cover up and minimize that tillage disturbance. Because keeping up your ground cover and not tilling are both good ways to minimize the carbon footprint of your system. So moving into perennial crops is a big help, and we think of cover crops as a way to sort of perennialize an annual system by spreading out the growing season and providing more ground cover. But that's absolutely an open question and one we're trying to figure out.
Ah, wonderful. Thanks, George, for calling. I want to give Chase in Oshkosh a chance to join us as well. Hi, Chase. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was wondering, I know that corn is a prominent source in our Midwest as far as tilling and crop distribution and stuff like that. But my question is, as far as the carbon content in the specific crop, I know we have GMO foods and stuff like that. Is there any alternative source of plant that would be better suited for what you're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we are looking at a lot of different cropping systems in the GLBRC. We're looking at miscanthus, which is an enormous grass, and switchgrass, which is a common grass in the area. And we're also looking at some woody species like poplar. In this particular part of Wisconsin, corn is so well adapted and really so well engineered to grow a lot of biomass that it's a really successful crop for ethanol production. But we're trying to figure out if there are alternatives because mm-hmm. of the problems with annual cropping systems we've talked about.
Yeah, and definitely a lot of it depends upon the soil that you're working with as well. As I mentioned earlier, in terms of some of these marginal lands, you know, we have a lot of studies which show if you're trying to, you know, get biomass, especially this fibrous cellulosic-based biomass in the marginal lands, you can actually get a better yield with something like switchgrass than you actually would with corn, actually, and be building soil at the same time. So a lot of it is kind of as a case-by-case basis. You really need to look kind of field by field at what's going on in the system.
Mm. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And before we go back to the phones, again, there's open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. And Doug, we'll get to you in just a second, but I want to go back to Anna to talk a little more about your research, because we really haven't zeroed in on what you're doing here, the specifics of it. So you're using winter rye and bluegrass, and
right.
Talk about those two crops and why you're using them.
Right. Well, winter rye is a pretty common cover crop in the area because it's easy to establish at the end of a corn growing season, or easier than other grasses. It'll grow well over the winter and give you a little bit of biomass before you have to plant corn in the spring. So we're using that as kind of a baseline cover crop that a lot of farmers already know how to work with, which is a nice feature.
So what are you doing? You're planting it?
Yeah, you plant it after you harvest the corn. Sometimes you harvest the corn a little early, say for silage or high moisture corn, to give your rye as best a chance as it can to get established before the freeze. And then we'll kill the rye off and just let it die in the field before we plant corn in the spring.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what are you doing?
Yeah, I'm
trying. You're not just sitting there watching it. You must be doing
some days. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out all the carbon added by the rye. So I measure the rye biomass, and I also measure the soil respiration. So under the ground, soil microbes are breathing out carbon dioxide just like us, and you can measure that carbon dioxide efflux from the soil. So I measure that regularly and try to get at whether the soil is breathing out more CO2 under cover crops or not.
And so you go ahead, John.
I was just going to say that really ties back into the earlier caller in regards to concerns about greenhouse gas emissions. So, mm-hmm. Tracking this carbon, is really important in terms of our thinking about how we can develop next generation biofuels, which will really, lessen our impact in terms of global warming, in terms of climate change. How do we mitigate that phenomenon? How can we do a lot better than, what we're doing today in terms of using gasoline and diesel, et cetera.
So it's pretty cool because you're, as you said early in the show, we're actually capturing more of the sun's energy,
mm-hmm. right?
In this fashion, and so we're planting it after the fact. Now, you mentioned bluegrass as well. Of course, I immediately think of Kentucky bluegrass. Is that what you're using?
Yeah, it is actually. So this is a kind of an novel cropping system in that ideally you essentially strip till corn rows into a field of bluegrass. So you maybe have a 1 foot wide strip of bluegrass in between your corn rows or something like that. And you may have to use a partial dose of herbicide to keep the bluegrass from being too competitive with the corn, because the corn is still your primary crop. Mm-hmm. But it's, intercropping is an ancient practice of trying to have two different plants growing next to each other. And we're experimenting with that simply to build soil carbon. That's kind of how I'm thinking about all my research. What would a farmer do if they were just trying to build soil carbon?
And so the grass would just stay there, would be in there all the time, permanently?
Or? Yeah, it's there year-round. So you knock it back a little bit with herbicide when you plant the corn, so the corn has a chance to grow up. But once a corn canopy closes, the bluegrass underneath isn't going to be that competitive for light. So it's just a matter of whether everything's getting enough water. And we're tracking that. We're tracking whether corn is successful next to bluegrass, or successful enough is really the parameter.
And the grass itself, when you're running over it with...
It's fine. I mean, you run a lawnmower over it, and run a tractor over it, too, as long as it's not too wet.
All right. Doug in Lancaster has a question. Hi, Doug. Thanks for calling.
Hi there, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question with regards to the increase in corn production and corn growth in this country. With the contrast to the increase in drought and other dry conditions around the country, corn requires a great deal of water. What kind of effects are we seeing on the water table around the country? And is there any opportunity to preserve the water use from growing corn and using alternative crops? Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling, Doug.
Yeah, tracking water is really important. I think there's not a lot of appreciation for the interrelationship between our energy use and our water use, but the two are inextricably connected, and that's definitely the case when we look at bioenergy systems. And you're completely right that corn does use a lot of water, and actually we have a number of experiments where we're looking at all these different types of potential crops and really tracking how much water is being used. And also, correspondingly, you were talking about drought. It's really critical as we look forward and we recognize that most likely, when we look at what's going on in terms of climate change, we're going to see more extreme weather events such as drought, more heat. How do we look forward to crops that are going to be more resilient to those types of conditions? And actually, this is where some of the perennial perennial crops we've been talking about are a significant opportunity. Crops like switchgrass overall are much better at handling some of these drought conditions. They have roots, because they are perennials, that, you know, if there's a meter of grass above ground, there's going to be 10 meters below ground, so they can really take advantage of some of these deeper reserves, while corn roots are really much more
shallow
on the surface, much more shallow. So, and then in terms of, like, you know, water table issues, you know, it's, once again, this is the kind of thing where we just need to really look different regions, different areas. It's going to make a pretty big difference. But we do have some very recent results which show that these perennial crops, at the very least, aren't drawing down more water than some of the annual crops that we're more familiar with, such as corn. So tracking these, the water use, and thinking about how plants respond to you know, things like drought is very important, and we're seeing a lot of success there.
Thanks very much for that question. I really appreciate it. Joe in Platteville, up to you next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, I'm a farmer out here in Platteville, and I make round bales, and I've got cover crops, and so I've experienced some of the stuff you're talking about, and I think the cover crops are great. But on the corn stalks, do you know, does your guest know how many, if you take a 1,000-pound bale, how many pounds of phosphorus and potash and your other micronutrients are you giving up to sell that bale for $25 or $30? And then another question I have is, if you burn a 1,000-pound bale, how many BTUs do you get out of it? And then on the BTUs you get, how many pollutants do you put in the air? Because you're still putting pollutants into the air, the same as coal. So how does it compare to coal per BTU gained? I guess, does that make sense?
Yeah. You've been doing some thinking about this, haven't you, Joe?
Yeah, you got to look at those bales all day and think about something. I understand.
Yeah?
Well, soil will build at about a sheet of a paper a year, if you don't remove all the stalks and stuff.
That's
once
nice
you start removing the stalks and stuff, then you could actually go the other way.
Yeah.
So, and you have a certain amount of erosion per acre. No matter what you do, you can't prevent it all. So can you afford to be on almost every acre of ground in Wisconsin, you can't afford to lose your humus, because you're losing it naturally anyway. So I guess, how does that equate? It almost seems like a like a catch-22.
Right.
Well, you're going to be removing some of that phosphorus, whether you take it for ethanol or for feed or for anything, right? So that's kind of the nature of harvesting your crops for production. I can't tell you exactly how much potash is going to be in one bale. It depends on the content of your corn and everything like that. But you're right that there's a loss there, and you got to, as a farmer, always be thinking about replacing that however you can, be it with manure or fertilizer or what you have on hand.
I can touch on a couple other questions. So just in terms of, a real critical one was, like, how much energy do you actually get out of this process? And the answer is, when you look at this fibrous plant material and you look kind of nationwide, so we're not just talking at this point, talking about corn, stover, but also slash from forestry, growing switchgrass, et cetera, it's over a billion tons per year of opportunity. This was a large USDA study, and that translates to, if we took all that material and sustainably convert it into fuels, we're talking about, equivalent of about a third of the liquid fuels we use here in the United States. So it's a very significant opportunity. And there's just briefly, the other concern that you raised, which I think is also really important, is that whole question about pollution. And when we're looking at liquid fuels, we're actually converting it, into something like gasoline, ethanol, or similar. So it's not a direct combustion process, but then when that fuel goes into a car, clearly we're emitting something like, we're emitting carbon dioxide. What's critical there is to recognize that carbon from a biofuel is what we call, it's kind of recent carbon. So it was just in the atmosphere, and it was fixed by the plants out of the atmosphere, CO2 going into the plants, and then re-released when that fuel is combusted. So it's kind of it's just being returned through the carbon cycle from the atmosphere and back into the atmosphere, which is fundamentally different than when we're burning fossil fuels, where we're taking carbon that's locked underground and we're releasing into the atmosphere by combusting it. And really, at this point in time, time, there's no way it's going back in. We don't. We're not actually currently making fossil fuels, through the carbon cycle at this point in time. And that's where we get the buildup of CO2 that's causing so much of our climate change concerns.
Oh, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Chris in Burlington, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. I heard one of your guests speak about interseeding Kentucky bluegrass, I believe they said.
Yep,
right.
Cornrows. Have you guys done anything with Kara clover? And if so, what were the results? And how hard was it to establish?
So I haven't done any work on this, but I've heard a little bit of Ken Albrecht's work here on campus on Kara clover, and they have had some trouble establishing it over the years. But that is another potential interseeded crop. And with all of these, we've learned how to grow corn really well, but we haven't learned how to grow all these alternative crops really well. So it's a matter of figuring out whether the management works for your soil type, your weather conditions, your farm, your time.
Yeah, Ken's been working on that for a while.
Right. And any kind of, once again, we're talking about legumes, which are nitrogen fixers. So here we're now, we're going to be putting carbon back in the soil. But we're also going to be putting nitrogen that those legumes, in association with the bacteria rhizobia are taking from the atmosphere. So it's kind of a double opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Chris. Jane and Ashland, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I was wondering about, a couple of my catalogs list a lot of cover crops, and one of them is Canadian field peas, which would be a legume and fixing nitrogen, and if you let them go to harvest, they can be human food, and then you could turn over the rest of it. So what do you think about Canadian field peas?
That sounds like a nice win-win. I've heard that can be a pretty successful crop in northern areas. And we do have some cover crop trials in our plots, which include peas in with rye, to try and get some of that nitrogen fixation that John mentioned before, in addition to the carbon biomass that I'm thinking about in my research. So it's definitely a possibility. Like I said, if you can get it established and make it work with your system.
I can remember the days we've had a lot of pea production, actually, in the southern Wisconsin. And as a 16-year-old kid, I drove a pea viner about 20 hours a day, I think, in season.
Oh, boy.
It was, you know what? Talk about nitrogen fixers.
Yeah.
You bet.
That'll do the job. Jane, thanks. And Fred in Adams County, your turn. Hi, Fred.
Good morning. Hey, sir, I drove a pea viner myself young. Here's a question. I'm in my 70s. I've got a snowblower, a chainsaw, and my little motorcycle. I burn premium fuel in there. It runs better. And my question is, why did they push for 15%? I burn regular ethanol in my car, or my pickup, late model pickup, but I don't like this stuff. And I never bet anybody got small equipment that does like it. My chainsaw is almost new, and they said burn premium fuel right off the bat. So the question is, two questions. Who pushed that for 15% ethanol? Number two, I wonder how many people go up to a gas pump anywhere in the state and don't even use ethanol. They go premium. I'm sorry it has to be that way, but we just don't like that stuff.
All right, there you go. And you're working on that too, aren't you, John?
Yeah. So yeah, there's a number of different pieces there. So in terms of those two cycle engines, your chainsaw, etc. As I understand it, you're fine using E10 in there as long as you keep moving fuel through. But where you really end up with a problem is if you start to store those two cycle engines for any period of time. So you're probably right. If you want to be kind of better safe than sorry, you might just want to use 100% ethanol in those. Those small engine pieces of equipment. In terms of kind of moving from E10 or 10% ethanol to E15, there's some real important considerations there. It does provide us, with the opportunity of using more ethanol, hopefully from sustainable sources, such as, the cellulosic material, which will really provide us with the opportunity to significantly reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, provide all sorts of different other opportunities in terms of energy security, et cetera. So, you know, I think there's a lot of research that's been done, and clearly there will be more in terms of how far can we go in terms of how much ethanol can we put into our vehicles. Clearly, you can get flex fuel vehicles, you know, that can use up to 85% ethanol. So
there's still work to be done. But if you take a look at the product now versus the ethanol product of 20 years ago, it's got to be almost a sea change difference, isn't it? And
yeah, it's always tricky when we talk about ethanol, because we like to think that all ethanol is created the same. But the fact is, where that ethanol comes from makes a very big difference. You know, where we kind of started out the show, in part, we were talking about ethanol from corn grain, and, you know, how sustainable is that? There's a lot of details there. But it's very clear that when we look towards the future, you know, and beginning now, we do have commercial scale plants that have just come online in the past year where we're making this ethanol from this residue material, corn stove. Actually, in other parts of the country, they're making ethanol from woody residue as well. And the opportunity is really significant there in terms of that being more environmentally friendly, also providing significant additional economic opportunities for forestry, for people who are working in our northern woodlands, et cetera. So we kind of need to look at the whole system.
And Anna, have you any findings yet from your side? I know you're sort of just getting going on this, but...
Yeah, it looks like the rye is probably a better deal for sequestering more carbon than the bluegrass or the no cover crop system. So we are seeing evidence that cover crops can help. And I'm trying to figure out a little bit more about why that is, looking at decomposition in those systems to try and understand the nitty gritty of the processing of plant to soil carbon.
I was kind of smiling to myself when you were talking about Kentucky bluegrass, because I thought, well, the first thing you're going to have is a whole bunch of creeping Charlie in there.
it's not a pure field.
I thought you were going to think about people teeing off in our cornfields, right?
There's a multi-use
I thought immediately of creeping Charlie. That comes up a lot on this program at one point or another. So your project's on how many years have you got to work on this?
Yeah, I've got a couple more field seasons. And like I said, I'm moving more into this decomposition process. Because when you have a cover crop on the soil, you're increasing the amount of biomass there, and you're also changing the temperature and the moisture of the soil and the surface, and that's going to change how fast things process. So I'm going to start trying to think about that. How fast are things being processed? How fast are plants being broken down? And how much CO2 is being released because of that?
And working with Randy Jackson, right?
Yeah, Randy Jackson. He's primarily a grassland ecologist. He's gotten into these biofuels, grasses, and then corn, the big grass.
Well, it's been great talking with you both. Thanks so much, and hopefully we have you back sometime to talk about some real positive results from your research.
Yeah, I hope so too, Larry. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks, John. John Greenler directs education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And Anna Cates, Great Lakes, works through the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center in many ways. She's affiliated with it through the agronomy department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, working on her PhD in this area. So it's really pretty interesting stuff. Of course, John comes by every month, pretty much, or every other month at least. And he'll be back, and probably Anna, too, at some point. So we'll talk some more with them. But we're also going to turn our attention a little bit to weather and tell you what. We had a tornado touchdown in Rock County, and Steve Ackerman, he's got a big smile on his face. He's sitting over there waiting to sit down in front of the microphone. John Martin is cuddling up to his telephone, and he'll be with us as well, and we'll be talking with them. Coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, a look at the weather.